and as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. For those of you who follow this series, you will note that we've been focusing primarily on the 13 British colonies that became the United States. We've been 13 colonies-centric. However, there were many other European nations with colonies in North and South America. Our goal for the next part of this series is to develop a better understanding of these other colonies. How did they react to the Declaration of Independence? Did they try to follow the American rebels' lead? What did they think about the new, free United States? And how free did they think it was? Our next episodes will feature expert guests discussing French Canada and Spanish Florida, but today we'll be looking at Caribbean history, particularly the history of Hispaniola, the island that now consists of the two countries, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. More specifically, we'll be looking at the colony of Saint-Domingue, the French part of Hispaniola, which is what we now call Haiti. We'll also examine the extraordinarily complicated concepts of race and freedom throughout the various European colonies. What does that mean, race and freedom? Well, just to try to give you an example, you could be a man of color as a slave in one colony. You could then escape and become a man of color who is free in another. And then you could even go back to yet another colony to fight for independence from Britain or France. As I said, it's complicated. But I have a very special guest with me today to help us untangle this mystery, historian Ronald Angelo Johnson. Welcome, Professor Johnson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ron holds the Ralph and Bessie May Lynn Endowed Chair of History at Baylor University. He is co-editor of the Journal of the Early Republic and a prolific author on diplomacy and race in American history. His latest book is Entangled Alliances, Racialized Freedom and Atlantic Diplomacy During the American Revolution, published by Cornell University Press. And the book is the subject of our conversation today. But before we get to that book, you started with that fascinating passage from the Declaration of Independence. Why did you choose that passage to begin our episode today?
Yes, and I want to thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to highlight that particular passage. And I want to say that the entire document, the Declaration, is a masterpiece of literary brilliance, of social courage and international audacity. But that passage in particular really speaks to me about the infinite importance of that declaration and the largesse of what it was doing in that moment. And just to give you a sense of how major that line was, and that line that I read comes right before that very popular, very famous line, which is very moving, where they pledge their to each other, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Well, that passage about war and peace and alliances comes right before that one. And it was so striking, that line was so striking, that when John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail the day after the vote had been taken, the day after they had voted on independence, it was that line that he included in his letter. It was the only line of the Declaration that he included in his letter to his wife, who was his best friend. And I found it just striking that of all the lines in that document, that's the one that John Adams thought was most significant for Abigail to know about before she read the entire document. And it speaks to me personally, because I have, for a long time, probably going all the way back to graduate school, have just been enamored with the diplomacy of the United States. And that's someone who's speaking as a person who grew up in the United States that was a hegemon or a superpower, but I've always been curious about where did the United States get this idea of diplomacy and how it was going to interact with other nations in the world. And what we see from the line that I read, the diplomacy of the United States is in its DNA. It's in the founding document. And I'll pause right there because I could go on for a while, but that one line really reminds me that peace and diplomacy was just as important to the founding generation at the moment of the inception of the United States as war and conquest.
You raised so many fantastic points there. The one thing that struck me is that sort of one of the hallmarks of being independent is even being able to choose how you want to behave in the world. Before that, foreign policy is dictated by Britain in London, right? By the king. And so once you give yourself this freedom to be an independent player in the world, it's almost like a child turning 18. You know, well, now I'm responsible and independent. What the heck do I do?
Oh my God, your analogy there, I think, is spot on, because up until 1776, you know, many of the men who were in that room at the Continental Congress had experience as either in British leadership, but they were doing things the British way. And what I find so fascinating about American diplomacy in particular is they're creating a way that they're going to do it themselves. Much of it they've learned from the British, but like that 18-year-old young adult, you can see from the Declaration in those early days of American independence, them moving slowly and slowly away from the parent country. And I love that. I love that analogy because I really do think you hit the nail on the head there.
Okay, so good. Fascinating introductory quotation that we have not discussed before, so that's perfect. All right, so new country. New country doesn't come from nowhere, just as the 18-year-old doesn't come from nowhere. So we're basically going to limit our timeline today from the first Treaty of Paris in 1763, and we're going to end it roughly with the second Treaty of Paris in 1783. And just to remind our audience, we've discussed a lot. We've often mentioned the first Treaty of Paris ending the Seven Years' War or the French and Indian War between France and Britain. We haven't really discussed at all the Second Treaty of Paris in 1783, and that was the treaty that ended the Revolutionary War and sort of certified the independence of the 13 North American colonies. So, Ron, why don't you just start with a short review of the First Treaty of Paris and how it helps us understand this concept of diplomacy and race.
Yeah, no, thank you again, because I think that construction of 1763 to 1783 is really helps me explain kind of why and how I see the Caribbean being so important to the American Revolutionary story. The Treaty of Paris, 1763, ended the Seven Years' War. And I actually begin my new book. I actually begin with it because I find it so ironic that in the first article, right? And you guys have probably covered this on the show, but the first article says there should be a general oblivion of everything that may have been done or committed before, right? There's this pledge that we're not going to hold each other responsible for the things that have been done, you know, in this kind of nod toward peace. But what we see over the next 20 years is decisions that are being made based on things that had happened previously. Much of the run-up to the War of Independence, much of the continued animosity between Britain and France is going to be because of the treaty that they had just signed. I just find that the treaty did end one war, and a global war. So it's a great thing in that it did that. But it set the stage for the animosities and policies that are going to come out of that and lead to further aggression between Britain and what's going to become the United States.
Maybe you can maybe talk a little bit about how the Treaty of Paris affected the Caribbean colonies, if at all.
Yes. And so, you know, when we think about the Treaty of Paris, we generally think about, you know, British North America, Paris, London, but so many people were affected by this treaty that we often don't think about. And I'd like to first go to Africa, right? Because in Article 10, and that'll get me back to the Caribbean where I'm trying to go. In Article 10, right there, during the war, so West Africa, as your listeners will know, was incredibly important to Europe and the colonies across the Western Atlantic world because of slavery and slave labor products. And so during the Seven Years' War, there were back and forth battles to take certain parts of Africa for the control of the population that could be enslaved and then turned into profit on the other side of the world. And in that document, in the Treaty of 1763, there were negotiations around Article 10, where the Gorée Island, the island on which, and it's very famous in the United States today because the door of no return is located on Gorée Island off the coast of Senegal. And in the treaty, Britain gave that up to France. Britain allowed France to have, it had been France. Britain took it during the war. And the concession was that they gave it back. They gave that island back, that major port of departure, gave that back to France. But at the same time, they made sure to keep hold of the Senegal River that led to the populations where they could continue to enslave people from Africa. So, right in the document itself, we see the importance of slavery. We see the importance of race right there. And after the treaty is enacted, France is going to lose much of its North American territories, which means its Caribbean holdings, the French Caribbean, is going to become more and more important to the French Empire, which means France is going to need those Caribbean islands to produce more slave labor products to offset the losses of profit they would get from North America, which in turn means Gorée Island is going to see more and more Africans depart from there to offset that because of what happened in the Treaty of 1763.
So in short, one consequence that we haven't discussed at all of the Treaty of Paris is that what it did was sort of kickstart the slave trade even more to the French Caribbean. Is that correct?
That is correct. You see a major uptick in the arrivals of Africans in Saint-Domingue and other French Caribbean nations after 1763.
Good. Really interesting. So the first Treaty of Paris. Now, in the 13 American colonies, we see that some of the consequences of the Treaty of Paris for colonists was it angered some, it restricted what they felt was their right to expand further west. So other problems with the Treaty of Paris meant that, you know, the British Empire was in great debt. So some of these tax increases levied on the colonies, the Stamp Act, really were just some of the many things that led more and more American colonists to be disgruntled with King George and Parliament. I think what we don't quite understand is how parliamentary decisions in London or King George's decisions in London were affecting the Caribbean.
Great. No, thank you so much for that question. And I want to set the scene here to remind our listeners that what people in North America understood what was going on in the Caribbean because of newspapers. They kept up with what was going on in Saint-Domingue, in Barbados, in Jamaica, because of the constant flow of newspapers on ships back and forth across the Atlantic, and vice versa, that people in the Caribbean were keeping up with what was going on in British North America through newspapers. And so by looking at it this way, reminding ourselves that that the Caribbean and British North America were connected by trade, they were connected by news, they were connected by communication, and they were connected by the occurrences that came out of the Treaty of 1763, it helps us not to see what was going on in British North America as isolated events, as if they're the only ones experiencing this. Because in Saint-Domingue, and I'll pick up where we left off in that previous conversation about slavery, the French had just been defeated by the British. And they were they were afraid. They were really afraid that the British were going to come and take their Caribbean holdings. They had just taken large holdings of French North America. they really were afraid that the British, unprovoked, were going to come and just take Saint-Domingue, take Martinique, take Guadeloupe and others. And so one of the first things they began to do was fortify those islands. They began to build military fortifications. They began to send other military reinforcements. What that did racially on the island of Saint-Domingue was it meant that the island's defense was going to depend on people of color. At the time, and in 1763, at the time, the populations were still quite roughly similar between white colonists and free people of color and enslaved people. There were more enslaved people, but between free people of color and white colonists, they were about the same. But in those provisions for military service, white colonists were given a way out. They could pay an indemnity. They could pay a tax. You know, which again, that replenished the French coffers, but it also meant that people of color were going to be the first line of defense for the island.
Free people of color.
Free. Yeah. Thank you very, very much for the clarification. Free people of color. And that is where we begin to see these racial divides that did not exist prior. There was a great deal of parity, not one-to-one parity, but free people of color prior to the Treaty of 1763 lived fairly equally to white colonists, because free people of color, we're talking people of mixed parentage. So many of them had French fathers. They had French educations. And in many cases, even before and after 1763, the free people of color were as rich, as affluent, if not more so, than white colonists. And so they took this incredible indignity that they were now being called upon to serve in the military like a commoner. They were being treated like a commoner. And so you see these racial divides that begin right after the treaty, and they're only going to expand. I'm going to go far in our timeline, well beyond our talk today, but these racial divides that begin in 1763 are only going to expand until 3 decades later, they're going to explode in what we then call the Haitian Revolution. I don't want to go that far, but I'm saying this is the genesis of that. The Haitian Revolution, like we're talking about the American Revolution, didn't just happen out of a vacuum. Neither did the Haitian Revolution. And you can see these fissures, and they're only going to get wider in Saint-Domingue. But that divide that begins in 1763, by the end of the decade, by the end of the 1760s, is going to explode into a military rebellion by free people of color in Saint-Domingue. Before the Boston Massacre, before the Tea Party, before Lexington and Concord, free people of color are going to rise up against their king in Saint-Domingue because of what happened with the Treaty of 1763.
Multiple podcast episodes just discussed right there. I mean, I have so many questions. So
please.
One maybe that you can answer just quickly is, so you've said that 1763, the treaty marks this first sign of increasing division between the free people of color and the white French colonists. I just can't even imagine a world where you would have such visible differences. You have people of color and then slaves and white people where it could everything could just be okay. I mean, how did they manage this social environment?
Yes, and I, first of all, that is a really wonderful question, and thank you for allowing me to talk about it, because I think for students, and we're all students, right? Even scholars are students, because we're constantly.
I am not a historian.
We're all constantly learning, and for those of us who learn about slavery in the United States, right? It's black and white. It's literally black and white. There's our mixed parentage, which we don't use this word mulatto much anymore, but there's that. But so you have these three really distinctive categories. In Saint-Domingue, you have upwards of 128 different categories. And so there, the capacity to live together with differences is much more complex in Saint-Domingue than it is in British North America at this time. And so it was not uncommon. And again, I know for people, those of us who study American slavery and emancipation, it's really difficult for us to wrap our head around that in Saint-Domingue, you would have a white French colonist married to a mixed-raced female or a black female, a 100% African female, and they would live and walk down the street and communicate with white neighbors just like everyone else. And you would have mixed race men married to mixed race women, and they would walk down the street and interact with everybody else. Mixed race men, men of color, would hire white men to work for them and fire white men. And so this was fairly common. Now, and you had slavery, and slavery, I want to say, for slavery was brutal. And it was deadly. It was mortal.
The only thing I know about, really, about Saint-Domingue was that it was known as the most brutal place on the planet to be a slave.
Yeah, yes. It was absolutely brutal, and the French slaveholders were brutal. At one point, the French government had to pass a law that dictated the minimum amount of food slaveholders could give or to their enslaved, because they would literally starve them to death. They would work them without feeding them until they died. Like, not only was the institution brutal, not only was sugar, making sugar a brutal technology, but the slaveholders on Saint-Domingue were also just brutal people to the people that they enslaved. And so by talking about these 128 categories, I don't want in any way say they were somehow more racially sophisticated or anything like that. I don't want to leave that impression on anybody. Racism and racial brutality existed there. And among those 128 categories, the one at the top remained white. Okay, like that. I want to be very clear, but it was a much more complex structure than what we are come to understand in the United States. But after 1763, the people of color, and they would say this, they were being treated more and more like the enslaved population. And we also have to remember that people of color also enslaved African people. And so to be treated like the people that you're enslaving was an insult to affluent people of color in Saint-Domingue. And you use this term at the beginning of the broadcast of complicated. Racial life in Saint-Domingue was incredibly complicated. And even writing about it, I have to make distinctions between when I'm using the word freedom, when I'm using the word liberty, and when I'm using the word equality, because those have different connotations depending on which population about which we're speaking.
Yeah, it's fascinating in its complexity, and I can see spending one's entire life studying it, as you do. Another follow-up question. To what extent is this strange, complex, multi-leveled, mixed-race society of Saint-Domingue, again, a French colony, what do they think about the slave colonies in British North America? What do they think?
No, that is an excellent question. And again, there's a French newspaper, a French language newspaper that begins in Saint-Domingue. It's called the Affiche Américaine, the American papers, right? The Affiche Américaine. And they keep up with that. Like, so they keep up with what's going on, with what the slaveholders are doing in Virginia, in Georgia, in Maryland. And likewise, what they're doing goes into the papers as well. And from what I can tell, from what I can deduce, right? And there are scholars who spend their whole life thinking about slavery in Saint-Domingue and slaveholding properties and slavery commerce. There's a whole literature around each of those facets. And I want to say, I read through those, but I want to say here, I want to give credit to those who've done the work, is in terms of treatment, in terms of technologies, it is as if they are operating really in two different worlds. We don't see much exchange of technologies and treatment going back and forth between the different realms, right? But what's going on in Britain is very different from treatment of enslaved people in Saint-Domingue. And while they're communicating with each other, they're keeping abreast of what's happening. That is one area where we don't see much in terms of treatment of enslaved people, getting the most. And the thing is, there are books written about this. French slaveholders are writing books about how to get the most out of enslaved labor. British British writers are writing about how to get the most out of slave labor products. And when, and here's the fascinating thing. When you read the books, you will see the English writers being cited in the French books, and you'll see the French writers being cited in the English books, but on the ground, going all the way up to the Haitian Revolution, the brutality of Dominican slavery, the brutality inflicted upon Africans enslaved in Saint-Domingue, you just don't see that level of brutality in British North America. And again, I say slavery was brutal and violent in every form, but there is just a difference that, and I'll just leave it at that because I don't want a proportion, but we don't see, from what I can tell, the treatment of enslaved Africans doesn't seem to become any better because of interactions between colonists in British North America and Saint-Domingue. Not that I've been able to pick up. And that's quite unfortunate.
Okay. So just a follow-up question from what you just said, and we'll focus on free people now. There was always this sort of xenophobic sense in the British colonies, even amongst British colonists, that they were more free than Spanish subjects or French subjects because of Parliament and the Magna Carta restricting the absolute power of the king. So the French and Spanish subjects had to always be less free than British subjects. So for the free people of Saint-Domingue, what did they think about their own freedom or liberty or whatever you would describe it as?
For the free people of Saint-Domingue, whether they were white Frenchmen or free people of color, they valued their freedom to the extent that, and I will say, I don't know that I've come across where they thought they were more free or less free. I have not seen this in the writing where they comment on, we don't want to be enslaved like the British or what, those types of pejorative views of what other people were going through. Much of what we see in the United States, and this is one of the things I really like about taking this view of 1763 and 1783 of the revolution, is that you see French colonists fighting back from the moment that they see the king imposing upon those freedoms, whether it is with military service, right? That's where it began. You're going to do military service, and they begin fighting back. Then the white colonists could pay a tax. And when they paid the tax, and again, you're going to see this play out at the Stamp Act. We're going to see it playing out with the Townshend Act. When they paid that tax, they took the white colonists' money, they took their tax, and then still conscripted them into the army. They still had to do the service. So they took their money. Because what happened was the people of color rose up, the people of color sent petitions. And this is something that people of color could do in Saint-Domingue that they could not do in British North America. People of color could go to the governor general of the island and have an audience with him, because that's the way freedom was being played out there. And so once they felt like they were having to bear the brunt of military service, they went to the French governor general. They went to him and complained. And he said, okay, I'm going to change the law, and we're going to have white people be in the military, but they had already taken their tax money and they did not give it back. So now you have white colonists upset with the governor. You have people of color upset with the governor, and very similar. And they're, again, remember, they're reading about the Stamp Act. They're reading about the Congress. They're reading all this protests that are happening across the United States. Now, nowhere, I want to be very clear, there's nowhere that I found that someone said, I'm going to protest because people are protesting in New York. But I know that they were reading that, because you see it in the newspapers. And very soon after those things start coming into the newspaper in Saint-Domingue, both white colonists and people of color begin to protest for their rights in Saint-Domingue. And that's going to continue. At the same time you have Stamp Act protests, at the same time you have protests across the 1760s, you're going to see white colonists and people of color. And this is something we're going to see in Saint-Domingue that we don't see, not to the extent that I'm going to describe in Saint-Domingue. We don't see it in British North America. Matter of fact, no, we do not see this in British North America. The uprising that is going to happen in Saint-Domingue is going to be led by a man of color, by a man named Jacques Delaunay. And it's going to be men of color, white French colonists, poor white French colonists, and enslaved people. You're going to have all these forces come together to combat the French government's action to get more money out of Saint-Domingue by committing what all these people feel are different levels of oppression, whether it's the tax for the white group, whether it's military service for the people of color, or it's a lack of resources for the poor white groups. They all come together, but they all have different reasons, but they don't mind coming together because they all see themselves as having a stake in being free. This is what it means to them to be free in Saint-Domingue. One, to be free for enslaved people, to be physically free, for people of color to be treated equally with white colonists, and for white colonists to have the liberty to live as they see fit on the island and not being dictated by the king. And there are similarities with what's going on in British North America, but there are also some very distinct differences with what's going on in British North America.
Oh, and it's great that you're talking about Saint-Domingue in this context of this entire series about the 13 British North American colonies, because we to everything you said, I'm just thinking like, yeah, of course, there are parallel tracks here. But what is sort of unifying the independence movements in Saint-Domingue and the colonies is the people have a certain concept of what their freedom and what their rights are. And then when this authority, this force across the ocean says, oh no, well now we're going to do this, this and that, people with all of their interests, freedom, rights, whatever, they have economic interests, they have social status interests, they have their own local powers, they have their own rights to control their own affairs to a certain extent. It's kind of those things more than some of these abstract ideas we see in the Declaration of Independence, like that all men are created equal, which obviously we know is not really what it meant. But what you see is just sort of when an authority tries to take what you consider to be your real freedoms and liberties, then people get mad. The colonists rebel. And that's what's really fascinating about this. Okay, we can talk about this forever, but we do need to move on.
Okay.
And we're going to tell a specific story. You will tell us a specific story. In my introduction, I mentioned that a slave in one colony could free himself by going to another colony and then go to yet another colony and fight an empire. So this is the actual story of Crispus Attucks. So why don't you just give us a little fun history of this fascinating person?
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I find it really bizarre that Crispus Attucks enters most histories of the American Revolution and history of the United States as a dead man. He enters our history, or the telling of our history, or the telling of U.S. history, on 5 March, 1770. And, you know, in terms of the revolution, that is an incredibly important day. It's the day of what we call the Boston Massacre. So I do have some understanding of why he enters there. But I think we do an injustice to the life that Crispus Attucks had lived if we only talk about him as a martyr. So I'd like to, and I thank you for the opportunity to go back a moment, because all those structures of being enslaved one place, free another place, enslaved, you know, all that dynamism that you described in the opening and you re-described here, that's his life. Because Crispus Attucks was born around 1723, enslaved to enslaved parents on a plantation around Framingham, Massachusetts, about 20 miles east of Boston, just like other enslaved people. So he's part of the slave narrative until his mid-20s. Until 1750, on the evening of September 1750, he leaves. He escapes. He leaves Framingham. He takes off and he boards a ship. I want to say here, one of the things that's really important is that he doesn't just walk away. His enslaver puts ads in the newspaper. This is how we know about this, right? Because his enslaver was telling us what was happening, because he describes what he left in. Apparently, he grabbed some clothes to make him look like a free person so he can make it to the ship. And then he got on the ship. And we do have to remind ourselves that merchant ships, didn't have a lot of scrutiny about who they hired. You know, and they're the stories, and I'm sure some, if you've had some of your maritime scholars on here, they tell these wonderful stories where ship captains would get people inebriated, intoxicated in a tavern, and then they wake up on a ship. You know, so it wouldn't have been that hard for a enslaved person, enslaved black man like Crispus Attucks, to show up at the wharf and hire himself out to a ship's captain. And that becomes his life. For the next 20 years, the next two decades, Crispus Attucks is going to become a sailor and sail into ports in British North America, across the Caribbean. And he creates this life for himself on the island of Bahamas. He takes on a new name. For much of this time, he's not known as Crispus Attucks. He's known as Michael Johnson. And again, that would make sense, right? Because his enslaver has put out a advertisement for him to be returned. But, and so he's building this whole new life of freedom. He takes on a new name. He's in this community of free black people in New Providence, Bahamas, which is something he could not have enjoyed in Framingham.
That's still a British colony. That's a British colony.
Sorry. At the time, Bahamas is still part of the British colony, British Empire. But he goes there and he's able to live there as a free man. And that colony that he lives in is a free colony. There is slavery. There is slavery on the Bahamas, but he lives as a free man within that. He lives as a free man on the sea. And so he is using the Atlantic trade system to empower his freedom, the need for goods, the need for labor, for maritime labor. That all works to his benefit so that people are just not, in general, they're not very interested in his status because he offers something to the maritime trade system. And then when he's in the Bahamas has this racial system that this area that's called New Guinea, that area where he lived, it was isolated, it was the black area. And as long as they lived amongst themselves and didn't upend the system, the government allowed them to exist in that way, and he did. And I think the fascinating thing is he would go from the Bahamas to the Carolinas, to Boston, to Philly. He went to all these ports. And what we find is on the night that he died, he's back in Boston, but he's in Boston waiting to get a ship to go to North Carolina. And here's the question that as I went through his life in the book and I put his life in the context of Atlantic freedom and enslavement, the question that I could not answer was why, when Crispus Attucks heard those bells ring out that something was wrong in Boston, that he left that tavern, he left that feeding house, and went out to sea. Now, most people thought it was a fire alarm because the bells meant fire. And so most people, when they went out that weren't on King Street, it happened on King Street where the assembly, the Boston assembled citizens and group encountered the British soldiers. Most people didn't know what was going on. They thought it was a fire. And so it made sense that he would come out in that sense. But the question, when he realized what was happening, why would Crispus Attucks risk re-enslavement if people understood who he actually was? Why would he risk injury for a system that had enslaved him and his family? And yet he did that, and he ends up being the first person shot. The first shots that went out, several of them hit him mortally and killed him rather quickly. And that is where most historians, and when we're teaching in class, that's where we pick up his story, and he becomes part of the revolutionary rhetoric. And I'm using rhetoric here in a larger sense, because what happens on King Street that night becomes the images of that Paul Revere puts out. Crispus Attucks is laying dead on the ground, or bleeding on the ground, in that image that's put out very quickly after. It goes in the newspapers, it becomes very popular, and then the week after the deaths, there's these images in the Boston newspapers that get picked up of the four coffins, and Crispus Attucks' coffin, the CA coffin, it's marked at CA on the coffin in the image, is there. So he becomes part of the American revolutionary fervor in very real ways. I think it is right to honor that. But I think we do him an injustice by not talking about the freedom that he had already enjoyed, and that he loses that freedom 20 miles from where he had escaped and gained that freedom two decades earlier. And then John Adams. So he's still part of the story, right? He remains a part of the story because John Adams, one of his biggest moments of the American Revolution. Okay, before we get to 1776, and it gets really big then, but John Adams really becomes known to the American populace, or at least the Boston population, when he, as an American rebel, an American colonist, defends the British soldiers that shot the Bostonians on that night. And in one of the things that I do in chapter two of my book in great detail is I talk about the way in which John Adams invoked Crispus Attucks as the fulcrum of his defense of the British soldiers. He understood the racial dynamics in that courtroom. And this is not something we talk a whole lot about. We talk about the Boston Massacre or John Adams's magnificent defense of this. So, because he had an uphill battle walking into that courtroom. John Adams had an uphill battle to convince the jury of people from Boston and in Boston area that these British soldiers should not be convicted. But he used Attucks. He used Crispus Attucks' involvement in that night to convince the jury that it was Crispus Attucks that caused the problems. He invoked, and I wrote this down somewhere, he invoked the word mulatto, that not white, to remind the jury was all white, to remind the jury that this man is not one of us. He invoked it 20 times during his oration that he was mulatto. Every time he referred to it, it was mulatto, mulatto, mulatto. And at one point, he even says, the riot, and I'm going to quote here, the riot was the behavior of Attucks, to whose mad behavior, in all probability, the dreadful carnage of that night is chiefly to be ascribed. He blamed Crispus Attucks for the death of the Bostonians, not the soldiers that pulled the trigger that night. And those men were acquitted, and some received reduced sentences, but none were convicted of murder, which is where it originally started.
Now that raises a fascinating counterfactual. What would have happened if the first person killed in the Boston Massacre were a white person?
It's a really great question. It's a really, yeah, really great question.
So I think what you described here with Crispus Attucks is just a fascinating concept. And for those of us who do spend a little bit of time reading about Black history, the various strategies that enslaved people used to liberate themselves are fascinating. And here we see one obvious method is just putting on a disguise and getting on a ship and getting the heck out of there. So why don't you talk a little bit more about strategies of Black liberation, please?
Yes, I will. And I'll come back to that wonderful word you used to open up the broadcast of complicated. Black liberation during the American Revolutionary era is complicated. There were so many ways in which Black people sought liberation. And I want to say here that Black liberation did not always equal American independence. And so I'll talk about that. One easy way, not one, it wasn't easy, but one way that comes to mind, because you see it everywhere, both in Saint-Domingue and the United States and all across the Caribbean, was running away. Running away was the most popular way of gaining freedom. A second way was marinage, right? Becoming a maroon, right? Creating these areas of Black community, which followed runaway. Because like sometimes people ran away to get to other places that freedom reigned. Other times they would run away to these isolated areas where Black people kind of controlled the area. It was in Saint-Domingue. It was in British North America, but they were in wooded areas, mountainous areas where white people generally didn't go. And so you had freedom with slavery all around. So that was another way. Marinage was another way. One way that we don't really talk about in terms of the revolutionary era was writing. Black people wrote in favor of freedom. They wrote to protest for freedom. And I'll give two quick examples here. One is Phyllis Wheatley, right? Phyllis Wheatley, she's become very, very popular. There's some wonderful biographies out there. But in almost each of these, she is known as a Black writer, a woman writer, or even a author of a slave narrative. But one of the areas I came across in this 1763 to 1783 scope was she was a revolutionary writer. As John Adams and Ben Franklin and John Dickinson and others are publishing these treatises in newspapers, Phyllis Wheatley is also writing poetry that is aimed at King George. She's writing about the majesty and leadership of General George Washington. She writes about the martyrdom of an American general in the American Revolution. So she's writing about that to show her that she's a part of this movement that is going on. Another person of color who writes during the American Revolutionary era is Lemuel Haynes. Lemuel Haynes he wasn't enslaved, but he was an indentured man of color, African father, white mother, raised by a separate couple in Granville, Massachusetts. He was born in Connecticut, raised in Granville, Massachusetts in the Haynes family. And he gains his freedom in 1774. Then he writes a year later about the Battle of Lexington. He writes a ballad about the Battle of Lexington. Now, there are ballads all over as in every revolution, right? Music and lyrics are part of revolutionary movements, and it was no different in the American Revolution. And Lemuel Haynes adds his voice and his words as with a ballad to Lexington as a man of color wanting to be a part of this movement. 3 months after the Declaration of Independence was published in July of 1776, Lemuel Haynes took the Declaration, and then he wrote a document called Liberty Further Extended. And he took Jefferson's preamble about all men being created equal, and he wrote this treatise, and it's about 20 pages long, of why if this applies to white people, if it applies to British people, it should also apply to Black people. He was calling for the abolition of slavery based on the principles of the Declaration of Independence 3 months after it had been published. So writing was another one. Fighting and fighting, being a part of the military. And being a part of the military, particularly in the United States, has been even up until present day, a way that people gain more status, more freedom by enlisting in the military. Black people got liberation by joining the British Army and or the American Army. As your listeners will know, in 1775, after Lexington conquered, the fall of that year, Lord Dunmore, the governor of Virginia, sent out a proclamation that any enslaved person in Virginia that fights with the British, he would pledge freedom for them. And thousands show up. Like one of the things about that act of liberation of Black people leaving plantations to join the British military against the American rebels, it's in newspapers everywhere. It took white Americans by storm that so many Black people would join the British to gain their freedom. On the flip side of that, Black people did join the American Army. And that's a much more complicated story because the Americans were very leery about having Black people, and they went back and forth. And it's really spotty depending on what regiment you're talking about. There's no one policy like you get with Dunmore, right? That becomes a policy for all the British military units in North America. It starts in Virginia, but it becomes a policy of the British military, whereas the American military is really uncoordinated in how they introduce Black troops. But again, in both cases, you have Black men fighting for their freedom, even if it means they have to leave British North America, or what becomes the United States after the war, they preferred to be free in Nova Scotia or Jamaica or even in Great Britain proper, as opposed to being enslaved in the United States, while others decided they would decide to remain to be enslaved in the United States as opposed to taking that. And that's why and how people make those choices. I don't think it's our job to pass judgment on them. Those are the choices they had in front of them, and those are the ones that they made. The one last area of Black liberation that I would call to mind that goes unnoticed is religion. One of the things about the American Revolution is that it is going to eventually bring about this idea of religious freedom. And what you see coming during the American Revolution, or during the War of American Independence, you have the creation of all Black churches. And I'll just name two here. One, which got, because I just think it's fascinating of where it starts, in Williamsburg, the capital of Virginia, the first Baptist church ever instituted in Williamsburg, Virginia, was not a white Baptist church. It was a Black Baptist church, an African Baptist church that began around 1776. So while this is going on, this church and what that allows to do. Okay. So like religion doesn't make one free. And I want to be, because we talked about this company idea of freedom, but being able to have a Black space where they can express themselves as Black without, beyond the, what we call the white gaze. That's what this allowed for. It allowed Black people to be able to congregate and share their religious experiences in ways that before were not permitted before the revolution. And I argue that this is a part of the revolution. This is the chaos. This is something that comes out of the chaos and the change and the uprootedness of the American Revolution. And you have the same thing happening in Savannah, Georgia. You have an African Baptist church that is created during the American Revolution. And what is special about the Savannah African Baptist Church, it was actually started by a Black British loyalist who is actually going to leave with the British when they lose the war. And then that church will be led by someone who decided to stay. So those are the different areas and ways in which Black people pursued liberation during the American Revolutionary era.
And Crispus Attucks is perhaps the most famous, and his story is kind of the most direct. But yeah, I think it's really important to recognize all of these other strategies that people used. Okay, so you got us wonderfully from very quickly there into 1775 and the battles of Lexington and Concord. So our next subject for today is understanding the Declaration of Independence in the context of international diplomacy. We started there with your wonderful little passage from the Declaration about saying we now can make our own alliances, we can do our own diplomacy because we are independent. So what else do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think as obscure as that sentence where we started that I read earlier might be, I think the understanding of the Declaration as an international document may be also a bit relatively obscure. But that was not the case for the men who created that document. The generation who was creating this entity that was going to be called the United States of America, they understood. And in some ways, they understood this because they had been a part of the British Empire. We've said a number of times, this didn't come out of nowhere. They didn't come out of nowhere. The knowledge of the power that the British Empire had, the men at the Continental Congress understood they were not going to be able to exist in isolation. They were going to need alliances. And this understanding was in place well before the Declaration. They were talking about this in the First Continental Congress. They were talking about it in the throughout the Second Continental Congress. As early as November of 1775, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin were talking to French spies in North America that had come over, because by 1775, everybody knew, the whole world, well, I won't say the whole world, the Atlantic world knew war was coming. Like, war was unavoidable. The rupture was on its way. And so the French were already sending spies to the Americans, to the would-be Americans, to talk about alliances. And these were active talks. And many of them, going back to Saint-Domingue, many of these French spies came directly from Saint-Domingue to British North America. So these connections between British North America and Saint-Domingue are just entwined. I mean, again, when I chose the title Entangled Alliances, I did it purposefully because everywhere I look, the United States and Saint-Domingue are in communication or in connection with each other in some way. In the spring of 1776, this is before the Lee Resolution, right? The resolution that comes out of Virginia that's going to be the kind of the founding language for the Declaration itself. John Adams is already laying out the principles under which the United States will relate to other nations. It's in his diary. Like, it's not published anywhere, but when you look at his diary, he has these notes John Adams understood better than most, but most Americans understood that the ally they were going to need the most was going to be the French. They knew it. And that, again, that goes all the way back to 1773, because the animosity that had been built from that treaty and from the French getting the shorter end of that treaty had existed. And the Americans in some way were cultivating that anger. The French wanted to ally with the United States to hurt the British, and the Americans wanted to remind the French of their animosity for the British for their own purposes. And so they were meeting each other right at the right time. Like, they both needed each other to hurt the British. But John Adams understood that the French were not to be toyed with. This was an empire in its own right. And so he made these notes all throughout the spring in his journal that said, you know, our priority is to safeguard the sovereignty of America. And that's right from his journal, right? That we're not going to have any political connections. We're not going to exchange one monarch for another monarch. The other one is that we will give them our commerce only. We will not have a military alliance because we do not want to be overtaken. And so these are conversations that were going on well before July 4th. And that is why in that document, that's why that language that I read early out, that's how it got there, because they had been thinking about it and talking about it from the very beginning. And only 2 weeks after the Declaration of Independence is when the Continental Congress forms a committee to lay out the foundations of American diplomacy. So it was there from the very beginning.
Besides the fact of sort of founding diplomacy in the new United States, was there any sense, you were talking about these Adams documents, any deeper than now we're independent? I mean, was there a style that they wanted to approach? Did they have some sense of like realpolitik, or what we think about in modern terms when we're studying international relations? Like, I don't quite know how to put this, because this was kind of a pre-theoretical textbook era. So how did they think about this in deeper respects?
You have this wonderful choice of words, Andy, that I really appreciate. You just use the word theoretical, right? Because everything I was saying earlier about John Adams was theoretical. Right. It was a theory, and they called it, and we still call it the model treaty, right? It was the model. John Adams laid this out, and he is the author. John Adams is the author of the founding foreign policy document in American history, but it was a model. The idea was these revolutionary ideas, this anti-imperialist idea, this anti-European idea. We are not going to be like them. We're not going to operate off of this balance of power, right? And that's a term that we use in diplomatic history quite often. We're not going to operate in this balance of power. It's not going to be you help us and we help you, right? He really believed that. Like, in all of his writings, he really believes that the United States itself, the principle of the United States, should be enough to attract the alliance friendship of other nations along with their commerce, that alone. He's trying to break this system of balance of power and these dangerous alliances. That's the theoretical. But Benjamin Franklin, who the Congress chooses to go and implement that diplomacy, had real world experience. John Adams had never left the United States. He had never left British North America. He's writing all this down. He had never been outside of the boundaries of British North America. Benjamin Franklin had. He had spent many, many years representing the colonies in London. He had traveled to Europe. And so when he gets to France, he goes there with John Adams' document. And he tries to negotiate that document on face value, at its face value. He tries the theoretical. And what he learns on the ground is that that is not the way the world works. And the United States, newly fashioned, was in no position to change the way the global diplomatic stratagem worked at that time. And so over the course of a year, he was there for, Benjamin Franklin was in Paris for a full year and nothing happened. The French would not budge. And he finally took it upon himself to change the dictates. And he conceded to France that, yes, we're going to sign this one treaty that John Adams came up with for commercial only. But then here's another treaty that we're going to sign that says, if you help us militarily, we will return the favor and kind. We will help you in a future battle, in any future battle you have with Great Britain, which was antithetical to what John Adams wanted, but it was the practicality. And instead of seeing these two men, instead of seeing Adams and Franklin as adversaries, I see them as co-collaborators. Whereas one had the theory, but one they started out with a theory, which in many ways, some of that policy, there's some of that still in the diplomatic minds of the United States to this day. And it was a guiding principle up to World War II. But on the ground, Benjamin Franklin realized the realities of American power and had to see to a larger power. And so I see them both as having come up with, and I argue this in the book, that Treaty of Paris in 1778 that recognizes the United States, that is an incredible, that is one of the most important documents the United States has ever signed with another nation. Because without that document, I argue there is no United States. Because without French recognition, without French military, without French funding, there was little chance the United States was ever going to defeat the greatest army of the 18th, and military of the 18th century, that being the British.
Fascinating story. So here we are. We've gone through the Declaration of Independence, and then 2 years later, Franklin successfully negotiates the recognition of the new colonies. But let's now take our story back from Europe to the New World. And why don't you tell us the story of the, and now my French is going to be butchered, the Chasseur Volontaire.
Chasseur Volontaire, yeah, you did great. That was great, Andy. Very nicely done. Before we get to Saint-Domingue, before we get on this side of the ocean, we have to go back, at least in my telling of the story, we got to go back to Paris. Okay. Because the Chasseur Volontaire, as you're leading into, they're going to come to the United States to help fight in the war, right? But before that happens, they come as a result of the Treaty of 1778. Without that treaty, they never show up. And one of the things I want my book to say overall, that what people sign on pieces of paper, on parchment, what is signed on parchment has real life consequences. And so this parchment, or actually it was two, the commercial one, but also the Treaty of Alliance in 1778, that is the commitment of France to get involved in the United States. And so when Admiral D'Estaing, Charles D'Estaing, right, the French military leader in the American Revolution, when he sails from Paris to involve French forces into the American Revolution, he goes to Saint-Domingue. He goes to the Caribbean and he augments his army, his armada, he augments his military force with men from Saint-Domingue. And among those men are Chasseur Volontaire, at least 550 free men of color and free black men who volunteer. They're not conscripted. They volunteer to join D'Estaing's expedition to go fight for Americans with Americans in North America. And so these 550 men in this unit, the Chasseur unit, with military uniforms, with military muskets, with ammo, they board the ship and they go north from Saint-Domingue to Savannah. That's where they're going to engage the British in Savannah, Georgia. And I want to pause here because this is a moment that gets, I mean, when I realized it, I thought we shouldn't move over this moment. In September of 1779, when you have 550 black men walking off a ship, fully armed and uniformed, that sight had never been seen in North America in the history of the continent. The millions of black people who had come prior to that, to that moment, had come as enslaved people. And even those who may have come as free people on passenger ships were coming one or two at a time. This is 500 men coming free and armed, not asking for anything from the United States, but willing to give their lives for the United States. And I asked the same, in the book, I tried to ask the same question of these chasseurs that I asked about Crispus Attucks earlier. Why would black people, why would free people of color risk their lives? And 263 of them are going to lose their life in Savannah or on the soil of Savannah. Why would they give up freedom? Why would they risk their own freedom for the independence and liberty of white Americans who enslaved black people? And for the people of color in San Domingue, it's easier to answer than for Crispus Attucks. It was because they were being discriminated in San Domingue. As we talked earlier, they were not being treated as equals. And they saw volunteering in a expedition to giving their lives in military service with some way advance their arguments that we should be treated as equally as any white man in Saint-Domingue. And similar to the Dunmore Proclamation, the French Governor General in Saint-Domingue had said any enslaved black person who fights with D'Estaing's army in Savannah will be given freedom. And so you see, some black men went to Savannah to gain more equality. Other black men went there to gain freedom from slavery. And what we see happening in Savannah is you have, particularly on the night of 23 and 24 September of 1779, you have men of color from Saint-Domingue, black men from Saint-Domingue, working alongside white men from Georgia. And I want you to just think about the juxtaposition of that. These white men of Georgia had probably never spoken to a black man as an equal in their lives. And yet on that night, they're there together digging a trench when they were attacked by British sentry. And the black men stood up and fought back the British and saved the lives of their white colleagues. But even within that short skirmish, you had black men and white men dying and bleeding together on the soils of Savannah. When people ask the question of whether or not the American Revolution was revolutionary, that is a moment that would not, that could not have happened outside of a revolutionary moment. And one of the arguments that I do try to make from this, and we talked about this earlier, about these exchanges between what people learned in Saint-Domingue from what was going on in British North America and vice versa. I argue in the book that that experience, the combat veterans from Saint-Domingue that survived Savannah, they go back to Saint-Domingue and with the air and the experience of combat, they began to no longer ask, but insist upon equal treatment. And it is not coincidence, Andy, that many of the leaders of what we're going to call the Haitian Revolution 10 years later, André Rigaud, Henri Christophe, and others were there at Savannah fighting up for the freedom and liberty of Americans and gained experience of how to fight for the freedom and equality for themselves.
That's such a fascinating story. It ties together so many of the themes we discussed today. I just love it. Okay, we are reaching the end, so let us finally maybe discuss a little bit the bookend, our second bookend here, the Second Treaty of Paris, which occurred in 1783, which ended the Revolutionary War strongly in favor of the new United States. So how does that impact some of the themes we've been talking about? Race in the transatlantic world, different notions of freedom and liberty, and of course, Saint-Domingue.
Yeah, the Treaty of 1783, negotiated again by, among others, John Adams and Franklin, right? They find themselves back together again in Paris. And that the treaty that they conclude with the British Empire, you know, and I think on Article 1, I really want to just read that very, not the whole thing, but this, that the His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States to be free, sovereign, and independent states. And that acknowledgement by the British King, that acknowledgement that the United States are free, sovereign, and independent, it goes back to that sentence that I read from the Declaration. In 1776, that was an aspiration. In 1783, with the King's acknowledgement of that, the recognition of that, it brings into reality what the founding generation had dreamed of. They really didn't know if they could pull it off. They believed it. And it came to be. And I just think that that sentence, every time I read that sentence in the treaty, it affirms the Stamp Act. It affirms Phyllis Wheatley writing to King George. It affirms Crispus Attucks' martyrdom. It affirms Lemuel Haynes signing up to be a Minuteman in Massachusetts. It affirms the treaty between the United States and France in 1778. It affirms the service and sacrifice of the Chasseurs Volontaires in Savannah. That treaty is the culmination of so much by so many for so many different reasons. There's freedom for some in that treaty. There's equality for some in that treaty. And there is liberty for some in that treaty. And this 20-year period from 1763 to 1783, so many have wished for, hoped for, prayed for, worked for so many different things. Sometimes they're working together for different reasons, but the Treaty of 1783 says to them all, your efforts, your belief, they were worth it. And that treaty, based on those beliefs, based on those sacrifices, what I argue, it irrevocably changes the Atlantic world as we know it. And it is without a doubt. I'm in no way saying that the United States is the actor of history since 1783, but I am saying that the United States and that belief system based on the Declaration of Independence has irrevocably changed life across the globe for so many since the signing of that treaty.
Fascinating. That was such a good ending. I feel almost sorry that I have to ask you the final question that I ask all my guests, or else people will be mad. So you're going to have to do that again. 250 years later, what do you think of the Declaration of Independence?
Yes, and I'll tell you what. If this doesn't come out as well as what I just said, feel free to cut it at what I said before, because that was all off the cusp. Okay, all off the cusp. But I love this question. I really do appreciate it. 250 years after its publication, I mean, I truly believe, Andy, that the Declaration of Independence, it remains as relevant and as revolutionary today as it was when it was first read in 1776. I mean, I see it as a document. I see it as a mindset. I see it as a worldview. I see it as a call to us, this generation, and those that follow. I see the Declaration, the words of the Declaration, as a call to us to carry forward the aspirations of that founding generations. And I think it's important to remind ourselves that the document represented aspirations. So it is in no way a kind of failure if those who wrote it didn't fully live up to it. Because what they bequeathed to us and those who will come after us is aspirations that I'm not sure will ever be fully realized in a lifetime of any one person or generation. But it is something that for the good of all humankind, if we continue to seek freedom, if we continue to seek equality, if we continue to protect sovereignty, if we continue to pursue peace, if we continue to seek the redresses of grievances, not just here in the United States, but across the globe. If we in the United States can partner, as that founding generation did, if we can partner with others across the globe to say we stand for peace, we stand for equality, we stand for justice, that, I believe, is the legacy of that document that lives beyond any words that any one man or group could have written 250 years ago.
Professor Ronald Angelo Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Andy. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.